Welcome to The Cooler Ring, a podcast for manufacturing marketers brought to you by Cooler Partners. My name is Jeff White. Joining me today is Carmen Perry. Carmen, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing well. You're doing well, I trust?
I am indeed.
Nice.
The deep summer recording sessions.
Indeed. Yeah. Well, look, really excited for today's guest. I think really interesting guest, really interesting company. And the topic is just one that I think a lot of a certain type of manufacturer, at least, struggles with. So I think it's going to be fun to kind of peel this one back a bit.
Yeah, for sure. I'm really pleased to welcome to The Cooler Ring, Jeff Urick, the Vice President of Marketing at Nanosys. Welcome to The Cooler Ring, Jeff.
Hi, guys. Great to be here.
Jeff, it's wonderful to have you on the show. First off, let's tell our listeners a bit about Nanosys and what you folks do there.
Sure. Nanosys has been around for a little while. The company was founded in 2001 to pursue commercialization of nanotechnology broadly. Actually, the founder was guy Larry Bach, and he'd had great relationships. He'd had a bunch of exits in the biotech world, great relationships with universities all over the world. Nanotechnology was a hot topic, and he just pulled in all this great research and IP from some of the top researchers in the world and started to just pull the string of nanotechnology and see where it would go. The company did a lot of research for a number of years, developing all kinds of types of products, silicon nanowires for hemostatic bandages to, quantum dots for solar, for displays, memory projects, all kinds of things. No products, though. So it was more of a research organization with very little product focus. That changed in 2008. CEO Jason Hartlev came on board and really focused the company down on a couple of products that that had a real path to commercial success. And that was quantum dots and battery. And pretty soon thereafter, we focused on quantum dot technology for displays. It felt like the closest thing to commercialization and a place where we could really add value. And he really focused the company on developing solutions for industry. So a big change in strategy when he joined the company. I joined soon after in 2009. First product in 2013 was the Amazon Kindle Fire. We got our quantum dot technology designed into that. We're off to the races. And then in 2023, we were acquired by a company called Showa Chemical in Japan. So we're part of a much larger Japanese chemical company now and still going strong.
Now, before we get into your background, which is also equally interesting, can you explain what a quantum dot is? Because I've been all over your website and I've done a bit of reading about it and it's really cool.
Totally. That's my job is to explain that, I think. So hopefully I can do that for you here. So quantum dot is a really amazing nanomaterial. It's discovered at Bell Labs in the early 1980s. This guy, Lew Bruce, actually just won a Nobel Prize for that discovery. And like a lot of cool things discovered by accident, he was working on something else and making these small particles. And he found that they could convert light energy into different colors. And the really special thing about a quantum dot is it's super, super tiny, true nanotechnology. Dozens of atoms, literally, between the size of a water molecule and a virus. So incredibly small. When you make things that small, you change the way they behave and you start to, behave by a different set of rules. Quantum mechanics come into play. And basically what happens with the quantum dot is the size of the dot changes the color of light that it emits. And we're not used to that. Things that are in the world around us, bulk materials, they reflect light and they are the color that they are. But with quantum dots, what happens is something called quantum confinement. So a blue photon, which has got a lot of energy, will hit a quantum dot. And the quantum dot kind of burns off some of that energy. It's like actually a semiconductor. It's converting that energy. And then it will emit a photon of a longer wavelength. So blue is short wavelength. And very, very small quantum dots can make blue light. And as they get larger into green, medium-sized quantum dot will emit a green photon. Big, big quantum dot will emit a red photon and so on. And so it gives you this amazing ability to tune a spectrum of light and emit very pure color at very specific wavelengths. And so that's turned out to be very useful for displays. A lot of people don't know this, but the display you're looking at right now, if you're looking at a display, uses red, green, and blue, mixes red, green, and blue to make all the colors you see. And so that was what we realized quantum dots would be very valuable for. Previously, you'd use something like a phosphor material, which like a yttrium alumina garnet, which is a phosphor you can use. It's very broad color spectrum, very yellowish. And we could use quantum dots to make a precise red, green, and blue and really improve the color and brightness and efficiency of displays.
Well, you know, Jeff, there have been a number of times in the history of the Cooler Ring when I've hoped that, you know, it would have been nice if we had video.
Yes.
As a podcast. But I'm happy that we don't in this instance, because our guests would have just seen me doing a dog watching TV look for the last. that was absolutely fascinating. And yeah, it's just so like, cool. Yeah, it's very, very cool. How did you end up at NanoSyst? Tell us a bit about your background. How did you end up there?
So I can think a lot of people's careers, it's an odd, you know, journey that you go through to end up where you are. You never would have seen this coming or pictured this. I started my career actually in the music business. I went to school for music, and I was worked as a recording engineer and record producer in Boston, a little bit in New York. In the early 2000s, the height of the Napster, difficulties and things like that. And so, it was a ton of fun. I loved doing that work. I realized there was something wrong with that business. You know, it was a very challenging time for that business. And so I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll go to business school, and I'll come back and work on the business side of music and sort of help to solve some of the business model challenges the industry was facing at that time. I went to night school while working in a night, industry, which was kind of an odd challenge.
There's no normal hours in production.
No, exactly. It's like, yeah, you start work at 7 p.m. actually. And so whatever, but made that work. And coming out of business school, had an opportunity to come do an internship out actually at NanoSyst in Silicon Valley. I was living in Boston on the East Coast at the time. And again, very focused on music and coming back into the music industry. But geez, you know, going to Silicon Valley, working in a tech company, I'll do that for 6 months and I'll come right back and I'll have some cool experiences, but I'll bring that, back with me. And kind of, I think 1 month in, I was totally in on Silicon Valley, the culture of it. And the company and the technology and the story and just, in head over heels.
Well, look, one of the great Canadian folk singers, probably the greatest Canadian folk singer, Stan Rogers, has a song called California, where he laments about all of his friends leaving the East Coast and falling in love with California and never coming back. So, it sounds like he did something similar. And that was written long before Silicon Valley was a thing.
Totally. Yep. It's the weather. It's everything. I mean, it's hard to beat.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. So we started... Carmen's dog watching TV moment was while you were trying to explain what this amazing thing quantum dots were and how the company arrived at this product. But that's also kind of what you've been doing as the marketer at NanoSys, is explaining to people what this is. And, perhaps even the people who might have been customers, potential customers of it, didn't know. And yeah, so I'd love to hear a little bit about how you kind of began to get this great story out there.
Yeah, I might say, I might position it, Jeff, like almost how do you get awareness for something that is practically invisible and people don't know it exists and it's part of a bigger thing, et cetera.
It's true. I mean, there's a bunch of different threads there. I think, a little bit of my audio background helped me a little bit in the early days. I can remember, drinking from a fire hose, of course, right away. And my office mate, this guy Zhang Sheng, and he's a PhD from UC Berkeley and so brilliant, and I'm just constantly asking questions about what is this? How's this work? But once I started to get a little bit of a feel for what was going on, I noticed the engineers were talking a lot about efficiency. So because we only make red, green, and blue light and not other colors, you don't need to filter out these other colors. You don't waste as much light. And that is a big benefit of the technology. It's more efficient. You get more photons out for the same amount of energy and that kind of thing. Which matters for mobile devices and for everything. But I noticed the color saturation was better. There was more color. And I started to pull that thread and started to understand the standards for how color works in broadcast and displays, and saw that there was some opportunity to expand the range of color you could show. And there's a lot of pushback at that time. People thought we had this color gamut. This is a standard for the range of colors a display can show, called Rec. 709, was associated with HDTV. And people thought that's pretty good. I mean, and it was pretty good, right? We're good. We got this. We don't need any more. But I had a little bit of experience as a creative professional on the music side, and thinking, yeah, as a creative person, you don't want to be restrained, you know, by this palette of colors that's so narrow, right? Turned out to be only a third of the colors our eye can see. I try to imagine, as an audio person, right, we get pretty good at reproducing the full range of sound our ear can hear, right? And so, you know, what if we could open that up, that palette up, and give that to creative professionals and let them tell stories with this broader range of color? And so I started to just kind of pull that string and learn about what those standards were, and talk to people, and just started a blog about that. And that was very successful for us early on, because other people were also thinking about this at the same time, and, you know, talking about how do you measure the color performance of a display? What does that look like? Why does it matter? We were able to get a lot of attention, and many other people worked on this at the same time, but I think we were a small part of kind of moving the needle on that and getting the industry thinking more about this color dimension.
And Jeff, what year was that?
That would have been 2010, probably 2011, when we started that.
Man, that was like the golden age in some ways of when blogs were interesting, and, you know, interesting people wrote them and other interesting people read them.
Yeah, I remember being very inspired by people like Seth Godin back then, right? And still, and just thinking, and this was also challenging internally, because we're very high technology company, very secretive, right? We're developing things at the cutting edge, and sort of telling my CEO, I'm just going to start writing a blog and giving away for free a lot of interesting things that we're learning, right? And of course, I wasn't giving away the recipe for the material, but still, just the idea of there's a guy in here who's just, you know, writing stuff and sending it out into the world was a little antithetical to the kind of, you know, R&D culture that we had. So
it's interesting. And we were reminding me of Hugh MacLeod back. I don't know if you remember the gapingvoid.com blog back in the day, the cartoons on the back of business cards guy.
No, I don't. That sounds cool.
That was all part of that same kind of era with Seth Godin, and he actually illustrated the cover of one of Seth's books. But he had this notion about corporate blogging that I think it was him and Scoble kind of named it, I think. And it was like the idea of like this porous membrane, that these types of blogs and corporations at that time, you know, everybody was worried about how it gave people kind of a look into the company, and maybe you were showing too much.
Yeah.
But then the reverse was also such a tremendous benefit, is you got to see more of what was outside because of the act of kind of kicking holes in that membrane that separates a company from those they serve and from the world at a broader level. My guess is the act of kind of being part of that, I mean, I'm taking a bit of a leap here, but did it help you kind of understand the application, you know, how the technology could come to life commercially, either quicker or better, or?
1,000,000%. I mean, it was so, I can't overstate the value of it. I mean, just one part of it was doing the work to understand things and using the blog as like it was almost like I was doing that research anyway. And I was trying to communicate those things internally anyway. Like, look, we're learning this about this color. Can we make a different red? Can we push this way? Can we do this, right? And sort of that two-way street. And so having the blog as a central kind of forcing function and, you know, wanting to publish something interesting, both internally and for me to learn and for the external community to react to. And then we would get amazing incoming things because of it, because we were talking about things, and it wasn't a big audience for this, right? And that was the other thing. It's not like we thought we were ever go viral here. But there's like 25 people in the world who are interested in this, but we really care about those people a lot, you know? And so I remember writing a one blog post about just thinking of places where wide color gamut would be interesting. And you know, talked about like a red lightsaber in a Star Wars movie, right? And, you know, how because one of the things we kept getting pushback on is like, well, in the natural world, you know, you might have too much color that's more color than you would see in the natural world. And I'm like, who cares, right? Go beyond. What could you do beyond that? You know, what kind of stories can you tell, right? And I wrote this story about that. What about a red lightsaber? What red should that be? Why should that be bounded by what we see around us, right? Make it crazy, right? And yeah, sure enough, somebody from Lucasfilm, you know, reaches out, you know, about these red lightsabers, you know, and then next thing you know, he's sharing information with me, not secrets about Lucasfilm or anything, but like, you know, here's how we think about color and we're interested in this. And we are working on this too. And so, wow, that's a great signal to get, right? And then can you make us a demo? So we're making, you know, handmade display demos that have more color than normal displays and sharing them with them. And I remember sharing it in a laptop with them and thinking, gee, I hope they like leave something on the laptop. Of course, it came back wiped, totally clean, you know, but right. Yeah, leave a version of Star Wars on here.
That no one has ever seen.
Right. Yeah. But I mean, that's just an amazing thing. And that's not a customer interaction. We're not going to sell anything to them, but it was still so valuable to learn how they were thinking and work together on that.
Man, like when I went to school as a designer, I had an 8-bit color monitor.
Sure.
Like one of the early Macs, you know, with 256 colors. And then, you know, we got 16-bit color and now there's thousands of colors and then 24-bit color. And
yeah.
And it's like, I mean, that was the mid-90s. So the explosion and the rapidity in terms of like the gamut that we're able to show and the quality of the screens has progressed so much in the last, you know, 30 years. It's really quite insane.
So much. And the costs have come down crazily also. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we know from experience with clients and what people are talking about that, you know, blogging doesn't necessarily drive the same. If you started a blog today, you're not going to have the same results that you had when you started a blog in 2010. You know, it's not driving the same level of success that it once was and all of that. But my guess is that because you were an early adopter of this way of talking about your product and storytelling and connecting people to this technology, you've maybe not experienced the same level of decline. How have you kind of thought about your blog over the years in terms of how you utilize that in 2025 versus 2010?
Yeah, it's definitely shifted over time. We're not as much in the early halcyon days of just literally like the learning about things in real time. And there's still a lot to learn, and I still do try to keep up with it. Part again, just for that reason of learning myself, keep pushing myself forward, keeping the internal team thinking about things, and you know, just get that porous membrane. I think I never thought of it that way, but I think that's such an apt way to think about this. But we have started to shift into a little different posture, and you'll see if you look on there now. We call it the point now, and we have some sort of interviews with customers, and we use it, you know, perhaps how you guys use this podcast a little bit. You know, sometimes it's not an active customer, but a potential customer or somebody we want to learn about, you know, a new market. We're starting to take quantum dots outside of displays. One of the cool things that's happened is that focusing on the display market has allowed us to build up the capacity for making quantum dots, making them better, brighter, more resilient, lower cost. As we've done that, new markets are starting to become like possible. What if we can put them into the agriculture market, into greenhouses? What if we could put them into pigments and paints? And so one of the fun things about the blog now is exploring some of those new emerging areas and, you know, reaching out to somebody at a company and interviewing them and trying to make it a promotional opportunity for them. So we try not to make it purely about us and hey, come on and say how great is Nanosys and how great, right? Really make it an opportunity for them to showcase themselves. But we think by doing that, we deepen those relationships and learn more. And then other people can see that and just keeps that flywheel going.
As you're talking about those customer relationships, it brings me to the idea that one of the challenges with your types of technologies, you can't always talk about where it comes to life. People aren't always all that keen to talk about who actually makes the magic in the component. I guess, how have you navigated that as you try to kind of evangelize this technology and get it out there, and you desperately want to show that world leaders are adopting it?
It's very challenging because, yeah, especially when we are more in startup phase and pre-acquisition, and you know, you'd have a major brand adopt your technology, and boy, you want to let the world know about that. Boy, that'd be such a validation point. It was often challenging to not be able to talk about those things, or skirt around them, and you'd always be feeling a little bit anxious. Are we saying a little too much here? What are they going to say? What are their lawyers going to say? I think one of the things that's helped us with that is going back to like that blog and delivering valuable content. And because of that, in many cases, the brands have invited us in. And before the show, I was talking to you guys a little bit about there's two sides of the brand. A lot of times we spend a lot of time with the engineering side, getting designed in, answering their questions about how the technology works, solving problems for them, right? But then I'm on the other side, the external communication side. And there's been a lot of value we've been able to offer there as these guys go out and launch the TVs. And, you know, hey, the engineering side told us there's this quantum stuff in there. What is it? And, you know, why does it matter? And in fact, in the early days, there's a lot of skepticism from consumers, cynicism, I would say, right? I mean, rightly, right? Oh, you put another logo on the box, right? Oh, now you're putting a Q on the box. Why do I care about this, right? You guys put some new thing on the box every year, and it's just a bunch of random stuff, right? They found it very helpful to lean into a relationship with us, and they would invite me out to product launches and would go hands-on with reporters and consumers and also retailers and help teach them, hey, there's something really going on here. And that was a lot of just hands-on work and doing handheld demonstrations. We would bring a spectrometer and they could measure the TV and see the spectrum of light. We'd bring a vial of the quantum dots and actually, you know, physically show them this is a real thing. And the brands found that so valuable. And that's something we were able to bring as kind of deep experts in the technology and help to tell that story.
So wait, a vial? You mean the quantum dots are liquid?
They're in a liquid, yeah. It's all solution-based material that we make. So we make them in, it looks like a big brewery, big steel tanks. It's amazing. I mean, it's truly amazing process. And this is one of my favorite little anecdotes to share, actually. So I'll just go down this road here. You know, we make them, the size is what determines the color, right? But they're super tiny. And so you're growing them as this giant, giant vat, you know, gallons and gallons and gallons, you know, 1,000 liters plus, right? And you can't just like take your calipers out and measure them, right? And so what we do is we shine blue light into the reactor as the dots are growing, and the color shifts as the dots grow. And when they get to the target color, we stop the reaction. And so we're able to make trillions and trillions and trillions of crystals that are all the same size, you know, plus or minus a few atoms, all at once. And it's just, I don't know, miraculous and crazy process.
That is so cool.
It's very cool technology, and the fact that it looks like a brewery is even cooler.
We ship them in beer cakes too, pretty much. Yeah.
I do think, I don't want to get too far past that. What I thought was incredibly instructive there, you know, because not everybody gets to market nanotechnology. That's incredibly cool. Sometimes it's the thing that they market's a little more bland than that, but they do encounter that same challenge about not being able to talk about the fact that they're part of this aircraft or part of this thing. And so often that roadblock is encountered when they're trying to produce case studies. And it's interesting to consider that case study, I mean, a case study by its nature is a very one-sided benefit. The person that's writing the case study is going to be the one that gets the benefit out of it. Primarily, everybody knows why you do case studies, is that so you can get more customers. But I liked the fact that the way you approached it, because you know, you think about if you have an owned media property, in your case, it's a blog that's evolved over time, et cetera, but podcasts and other, you know, there's you know, marketers can think this through. What's the owned media property that we can start or own to have today that is not just a get from our customers when we want to do a case study, but allows us to deliver them a bit of a give? And can, you know, not everybody's going to play ball. I'm sure that's the same for your customers as well. But more will play ball if you've got a different game to play.
So true. And yeah, and it was interesting, again, going back to my management too. It's like, it's hard to measure this classic marketing thing, right? Like, what is the value of this? We can't charge the customer more for this, but it's like, we're offering them an extra service. It's an extra benefit that they're getting to help them tell the story and market and reach more customers. So yeah.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting for our listeners to think about for their businesses, and just how does that translate? There's something pretty cool there, Jeff. I mean, look, your business is one that's incredibly innovative and progressive, and you happen to work in a part of the world that is also a bit on the edge technology wise. Where are you seeing the world of marketing going? And don't just give me a pat AI answer. I expect more out of you Bay Area guys. There's, you know, just, you know, we do live in a very interesting time, and the world of marketing and sales are shifting dramatically. What are you seeing in the next 12 to 24 months?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I mean, I think, and I love, by the way, that you guys are creating this B2B marketing podcast, because I feel like the B2B world doesn't always get that much love. And I always get that pushback, even internally, right? Like, oh, we're not a big brand. We don't need to do these different things. But, for us, I think, I'm sure there are big changes in terms of how you think about SEO and how you think, in terms of think about, you know, paid and things like that. That is just stuff we haven't really thought a lot about. And so, you mentioned it earlier, like we try to focus on creating content that's valuable for our customers and for the end users. We try to really think about those audiences. And I think we just try to focus on old school stuff like that and creating things and talking about things that are relevant to our users and to our customers. I think that's the through line we just keep following, even though, as you say, like if you started a new blog today, you know, what would that really look like? We know the audience is small. We're not trying to reach a broad, huge audience. We're trying to reach the right people, a very small group of people who are interested in very, very specific topics. And so we just try to keep that as our North Star, but it does feel like a lot of things are shifting and changing out there.
Well, that's instructive, though, because so many manufacturers find themselves in incredibly niche categories. And, you know, the more niche that category is, the more there may just not be a lot of other people talking about it. So you don't have to talk about it via maybe the most innovative channel. You just need to be talking about it.
I think that, to me, that's been the lesson for us. And you know, early on, holding yourself and trying to imagine, we need to go viral. We need to have some huge outcome from this, right? And it's like, no, that's not the stakes here, right? The stakes is reaching those few decision makers or the people who influence the decision makers and getting our customers talking and thinking about these things and just really focusing on that. And the tools are not as important to me, I would say. But again, yeah, it depends on your product. If you had a more consumer-facing product, I don't know. It'd be pretty challenging in some cases. But yeah, AI, I guess, you know, we're all using it different ways, but, you know, it's just another tool, you know. I don't know. I don't know how much it changes. We're not going to use creative that's made by an AI that I can see in the near term, right? But
Well, there's still so much for you to talk about that is unique and wouldn't necessarily even be available from a large language model because you're the only ones doing it.
Yeah, so. Exactly.
It's an interesting position, actually.
I really enjoyed this conversation, Jeff. It's been fascinating to learn more about the company and how you think about the various marketing challenges that you all encounter, just how you think about approaching the market. I'm just curious, as we close, what's the bit of advice that you're going to give yourself 20 years ago that you wish you knew then that you know now?
Interesting. 20 years ago that I wish I knew then.
I was I thought that your comment around your path through university, okay, I'm now going to go back to business school. You know, there's some interesting thinking there. And like so many others, you end up in a place you didn't expect. So I'm just kind of curious.
Completely didn't expect. I think, you know, and I mean, like, I think everybody experiences some imposter syndrome and that kind of thing. And I certainly had that, you know, coming out of a music background into a very, very high technology place. And people are really, really smart. And so I think I think I would just remind myself to just, yeah, keep pulling the thread of curiosity and following your interests and you know, not worrying too much about that stuff and being too intimidated. And again, just staying curious. And those are the things that have helped me the most. And in the early days, it wasn't always clear to me because, again, it was so intimidating and sort of overwhelming. But just, you know, reminding myself to follow that path.
Carmen is often fond of saying that be yourself, everyone else has already taken, which I think we've stolen from somebody else. But it's certainly applicable in this situation.
Yeah, definitely.
Jeff, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys. This is great.
Thank you.